loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. Al-Nusra, Al-Qaeda, and other Islamist forces attacked government-held Aleppo for days with scores of civilians killed. Yet the mainstream media was almost completely silent. Now the Syrian Arab Army has pushed back the counteroffensive. The resistance to the Dakota Access Pipeline in Standing Rock continues as repression intensifies. Today marks the anniversary of North and South Dakota becoming states within the United States in 1889. But how was the land stolen from the native indigenous people in the first place? Less than 1 week until Election Day, the campaign has taken yet another twist as the FBI reopens an investigation into Hillary Clinton's emails. Meanwhile, the Clinton camp continues to blame Russia, and the mainstream media reported yesterday that the FBI conducted a thoroughgoing surveillance of the Trump campaign to detect a Russian link and found nothing. But first, we turn to the latest in Aleppo, Syria. We are joined from London by Alexander Mercuris, the editor-in-chief of The Duran. Welcome back, Alexander.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us. Let's start with the news that the Syrian army has pushed back a counteroffensive led by the so-called al-Nusra Front in Aleppo. Tell us what happened. What was this counteroffensive? When was it launched? And has the Syrian military succeeded in crushing the counteroffensive by the terrorist organizations?
Yes. This was a counteroffensive that was put together by all the various jihadi groups that are gathered in and near Aleppo, and its purpose was to break the siege of the jihadi-controlled eastern districts. It was launched a couple of days ago, and it was directed against the southwestern areas of the city. The Russian general staff asked President Putin for permission to bomb the jihadis who were involved in this offensive. President Putin of Russia refused, and in the event, the Syrian army repulsed it successfully by itself. So this offensive was attempted. Allegedly, up to 16,000 fighters were involved in it, though the actual number is probably much less than that. But regardless of that, it failed.
So just talk about the strategic significance for our broader audience of the battle for Aleppo. Is it likely to be liberated from, in the eastern part, from forces like al-Nusra and the other jihadist forces?
My own view is that that's now only a question of time, and I understand that that's also the opinion of the U.S. government. There was a meeting of the U.S. National Security Council, chaired by no less a person than President Obama, in October, and well-sourced reports that appeared in the U.S. media basically confirmed that the U.S. is expecting eastern Aleppo to be liberated within the next few weeks. And I'm sure that will happen now. This offensive, which was an attempt to break the siege, was a last attempt to prevent that happening, and it has now failed.
For the jihadi forces, for al-Nusra, for al-Qaeda, for the Army of Conquest, for those forces that have been aligned together, that have gotten all of their aid and financing and weapons from either Turkey or Qatar or the CIA coordinating through Jordan starting in 2011. For them, is this a fight to the finish, or do you assume, Alexander Mercuris, that there will be some sort of resolution whereby these armed forces will be allowed to leave East Aleppo to go to Idlib or some other place?
This is what the Russians have been trying to negotiate for months. They've been trying to negotiate an arrangement whereby these jihadi fighters in eastern Aleppo leave the city with their light weapons so that the Syrian government can reoccupy by itself peacefully. This was what the Russians thought they had negotiated with the US over the course of the summer. And if you examine very carefully those parts of the Kerry-Lavrov agreement that was agreed in September that have now been published, if you examine those carefully, that seems to have been what that agreement was also about. It has never happened And the reason it has never happened is because of Aleppo's importance in this war. It was, before the war began, Syria's biggest city. It was its major industrial center. For the various jihadi groups, it is symbolic of their war in Syria. If they have a presence there, they are a serious contender for political power in Syria, ultimately in Damascus. If they're thrown out of Aleppo, if they have to leave Aleppo, then that ambition dies. And that is why I think they will fight to the finish to stay there.
But you believe they will, even fighting to the finish, that they will be defeated?
I'm sure they will be, because they are encircled on all sides now by the Syrian army, more forces from the south of Syria, from government-controlled areas of Syria, are being concentrated there. They are cut off from supplies, so they can't replenish or reinforce. And I think, as the U.S. government, as I said, thinks, their defeat is now only a question of time. But I don't think they will go quietly.
Let me ask you what you conceive or what you visualize for the future of Syria then, because if the United States has been propping up the resistance in East Aleppo, or let's put it, not propping it up, preventing its utter defeat. If the Russians at the same time have been trying to, and I believe this was also true for Staffan de Mistura, the UN special envoy to Syria, trying to arrange a corridor so that the armed rebel groups in East Aleppo could leave, in other words, not die in Aleppo, but leave and regroup elsewhere. If those things are not happening, and in other words, Aleppo is just completely liberated by the Syrian National Army, the Syrian Arab Army, the U.S. plans or Turkey's plans or Saudi's plans in East Aleppo are crushed, what's plan B for the United States? Because they're still not ready to work with the Syrian government, the Bashar al-Assad government, or work with it and the Russians in order to come to a final resolution of the Syrian conflict. What is plan B?
Yes, that's exactly right. I think Plan B is now gradually starting to emerge. It was apparently also discussed at roughly the time of that National Security Council meeting that I discussed, that I spoke about, which happened earlier this month. And we've also seen references to it in various interviews that have been given, including, interestingly, one by Hillary Clinton. Briefly, I think Plan B is to develop a safe zone in northeast Syria and perhaps also eastern Syria, which will be controlled by the jihadi rebel groups, form some kind of a political opposition government or authority there, and try and use that area, that particular group, that particular entity, as a bargaining chip in future negotiations about the political future of Syria. So in essence, what that actually means is a partition of Syria into a rebel-controlled eastern and northeastern area and a government-controlled western area, the government being in control, of course, there, of all the big cities of Syria. But I think that is the plan B now, and that is what the United States is working towards.
The U.S. Secretary of Defense, Ash Carter, when asked about the timing of Mosul and the possible timing of a U.S. military, U.S.-supported military operation in Raqqa, the capital of the so-called Islamic State, he said it was all been planned this way. In other words, that the Battle of Mosul would begin when it did, and that prior to the finishing of the Battle of Mosul, that's, of course, in northern Iraq and to the east of Raqqa, in other words, not on the border, but not far from the border either, maybe 75 miles from the border, that Raqqa would come simultaneously and sequentially and at the same time as the Mosul operation. So if what you're saying, Alexander Mercuris, is that in the eastern or northern and northeastern part of Syria, there is a so-called safe zone for the regrouping of armed Islamist organizations, the jihadi groups. And if the United States supports forces to retake Raqqa, would then Raqqa, the capital of the IS caliphate, then become central to another sort of constellation of armed jihadi groups, maybe minus IS?
I think that is exactly what the plan is. And that is the problem the United States has is that, of course, ISIS or IS or call it what you will, its actions have put it beyond the pale. So it has to be replaced. It has to be destroyed and replaced by the U.S.'s own protégés. What the U.S. does not want to see happen is Raqqa to fall to the Syrian military of that supports the government. In other words, to be regained by the legitimate Syrian government, which is why the United States has said very clearly that it does not want either Russia or Syria involved in the Raqqa operation. And that is why Mosul and Syria, the two operations against ISIS in Mosul and Syria, are being coordinated together and are being envisaged by the United States as essentially one and the same. It is all in pursuance of this Plan B we were discussing earlier.
And just another question then, because if ISIS is strong in Raqqa, which I don't know how many fighters they have, but obviously they have a concentration of fighters, and if the Battle of Mosul goes as it appears to be going, they may be reinforced by additional fighters migrating from Mosul back to Raqqa, then what's the ground force that could actually dislodge or defeat ISIS in Raqqa? It's certainly not the Free Syrian Army, the so-called moderates. Is it Turkey? Or how does, I mean, the U.S. can't put boots on the ground because of the restraints based on American public opinion following the debacle in Iraq. I mean, how does it all happen?
This is exactly the problem. And of course, this is the unanswered question. And one wonders whether, in fact, even the United States actually has an answer. As far as one can see, the original plan was that Raqqa would be liberated by the Kurdish militia, the YPG, that is working very closely with the United States. And that this, which is undoubtedly the most potent militia in the area, and that this would then be used by the United States as the vehicle to create its own statelet or protectorate there. The trouble is that is clearly unacceptable to Turkey and to the Turkish government, which has now also sent troops into Syria, as it has, of course, also to Iraq. Now, that means that the United States is faced by two completely conflicting parties in northeast Syria. One is the Kurds, the other is the Turks. And it seems to be having great trouble coming to any kind of arrangement that will involve both. So I don't know how the United States is going to actually liberate Raqqa at the moment. I expect Raqqa to be ferociously defended, just as I personally think Mosul will be defended as well. So I don't think this is going to be an easy operation from the US point of view. But we will have to see whether they have any answers to these questions.
Relations between Turkey and the United States have frayed considerably in recent months, and especially because of the perception by the Erdogan government that the United States, well, maybe didn't give a green light to the July 15th coup, but certainly perhaps a yellow light, because the U.S. did not give a robust demonstration of support for Erdogan in the early part of the coup. They sort of waited to see who was going to win. Certainly the NSA and U.S. intelligence services would have had some knowledge, even if they weren't given a direct heads up by the coup plotters, that something was underway, and they apparently did not warn Erdogan. Now, Erdogan has his own agenda in Syria and in the region, maybe the regained lost glories of the Ottoman Empire. Aleppo used to be part of the Ottoman Empire, so was Mosul. Do you believe that, I mean, this is how complicated this is, that the United States could rely on Turkey to carry out some or a bulk of the fighting in Raqqa? Then Turkey, of course, would have completely contrary goals and be opposed to the Kurds, who up until now have been fighting with the United States. And since the frayed relations between Turkey and the United States, especially following the July 15th failed coup in Turkey, Turkey has warmed its relations with Russia. And Russia, of course, would view any sort of offensive like that in Raqqa to be, and so would the Syrian government, to be an act of aggression. So it's really hard to see how all the pieces of the puzzle ultimately fit together ever.
It is extraordinarily hard to see how the pieces of the puzzle fit together. Going back to the things you said, I am absolutely sure that there must be some people in Washington who are at this moment in time arguing that the most effective way to take Raqqa is to get the Turkish army to do it, and that the Kurds, who are not really enemies of the Syrian government, or haven't really been at the moment, are people who should be put aside. I would be very surprised if there are not people within the United States who are government who are actually arguing that. And I would not also be surprised if that happened, because, of course, if the United States and Turkey were working together in northeast Syria in that kind of way, it might be a way of smoothing over the problems in relations that you have been talking about. The problem with doing that, however, is that, of course, it involves Turkey, which is a NATO country, in the war in Syria in an extraordinarily direct way, and it also sets Turkey and, by extension, the United States against the Kurds in Syria. So I am sure also that there are people in the United States who are arguing against it because they're seeing it as the start of a slippery slope that's going to create major problems for the United States in Syria and eventually in Turkey itself when it becomes, if it becomes bogged down in a war there. So it's not easy to see a solution to this problem. And, of course, one comes back to the big question, the ultimate question about this war, which is that if the United States cannot attack Syria, trying to achieve its objectives in this very in these very indirect ways are ultimately so counterproductive that it would be better for the United States if it simply stopped doing them. And of course, it would be far better for the region as well.
Yes, wise words. That's Alexander Mercuris. He is the editor-in-chief of the Duran. We're talking about Syria. We're talking about the Battle of Aleppo and what's coming next. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. The resistance to the Dakota Access Pipeline and Standing Rock continues as repression intensify. Today marks the anniversary of North and South Dakota becoming states of the United States in 1889. But how was the land stolen from the Native people in the first place? We are joined by Steve Russell. Steve is a citizen of the Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma. He lives in Texas near Austin. He is a Texas trial court judge, an associate professor emeritus of criminal justice at Indiana University, Bloomington. Steve is also a columnist for Indian Country Today. Welcome, Steve Russell.
Thank you very much.
It's a great honor for you to join us today, Steve. On November 2nd, 1889 was the date that the Dakotas became states. That was 127 years ago, just today. Talk about the history of Lakota Sioux lands and the resources being taken by the federal government. What other struggles have the Sioux people especially waged over these decades?
Well, I guess you could say time flies when you're having fun. This struggle over the pipeline is taking place right in the center of the end of the shooting part of the Indian Wars. The Indian Wars ended at Wounded Knee Creek in 1890 when a bunch of women, children, and old people were massacred by the 7th Cavalry. That would be Custer's outfit, but of course Custer was no longer with them at that time. It's just amazing to me that it's being replayed on the same land. There were treaties made at Fort Laramie in 1851 and again in 1868 that purported to set aside the Great Sioux Nation. That means a couple of things. It can either mean those tribes that were associated in the Seven Fires Council, or it could mean the geographical area that is Indian country up there. Heard people talk about it both ways. But in 1874, that gentleman named Custer made an incursion into the Black Hills, Pajasapa, and found gold. The result was a gold rush. I don't know if it's fair to blame the United States. It happened again and again. It happened to my people in Georgia, where there was treaty lands, and all of a sudden gold was discovered, and the rush was on, and there was no way to stop them. Black Kettle used to call gold the yellow metal that makes the Wasichus crazy, and I guess there's something to that. But anyway, Custer is the guy who found the gold, that started the gold rush, that led to what the Indian Court of Claims called settler incursion, meaning that you've got this treaty land that's supposed to belong to a certain people forever, and the U.S. government can't defend it. You could say won't defend it or can't defend it. You can argue about which it is. I tend to think it's more can't defend it. They just did not have the resources to keep the people out who kept coming.
So gold was discovered in the Dakotas. Of course, then Custer went on his rampage, and the settlers were coming after the gold. The same thing happened in 1848 in California. The gold rush, the indigenous peoples of California were basically assaulted.
The difference was, in California, they didn't have a treaty. The land was not set aside as it was supposed to be in the Cherokee case and in the Sioux case. In California, they had what I would call the worst, and this is a real contest, the worst Native American genocide on this continent. I mean, during the gold rush, they were hunting people down, men, women, and children, and just exterminating them. It wasn't a treaty violation because they had no treaties, but it was the worst human rights debacle this continent has ever seen. It was horrible. It was much worse. Here I am, a Cherokee, talking about the Trail of Tears. I got to say, what happened in California was worse. It really was. At least they didn't treat us as game, you know, to be shot. California was awful, and you're right. It was directly related to the gold.
So today we have what's called black gold, which is oil, which are the other natural resources, petroleum products of different types that are in the land. And of course, you have a replay, not of course in the same way, but it's a replay of the struggle over who will control the land, who will control the resources, and the driving forces in 1848 in California or in the 1870s in the Dakota. It was nascent capitalism. Now we're in sort of late stage capitalism, but we still have this sort of predatory interest driving the struggle against the land, the people, the culture, the history, the existence of indigenous peoples.
Yeah, there is something about how we are supposed to exist on this continent that the average citizen doesn't know, and I'm going to take a chance and try to explain it. People understand that in 1803, Thomas Jefferson engineered the Louisiana Purchase. That's not exactly correct. A delegation that he sent to Paris, and they were outside of their authority, and it was probably unconstitutional, but let's leave that aside. We got this thing in U.S. history called the Louisiana Purchase. What people don't understand is what was purchased. In those days, land titles, even in Protestant nations, flowed from a couple of papal bulls, the earlier one called Terra Nullius, that is the empty land, the land that nobody owns. And what that bull was about was not about land that was empty of people, but it was empty of Christian people. And it was authority to take property of anybody who was not Christian. And that is the basis for land title in the United States, which sounds kind of strange because we've never been a Catholic country, but that's what it goes back to. So what Jefferson bought was the right to acquire all of that property to the exclusion of any other Christian nation. And the ways to acquire it were to buy it or by conquest. Both were lawful at the time, but he didn't buy the property. He bought the right to acquire the property. And what happened in the case of the Great Sioux Nation was they put up a hell of a resistance. So they got these treaties that guaranteed them they could keep their property. Of course, that didn't work out. One implication of this, by the way, we just saw playing out in Oregon when the militia took over that wildlife refuge. What they don't seem to understand, the militia types think that if the federal government doesn't have the land, then the state has the land. Well, that's not true. Only the federal government can acquire the land from the Indians. And only the United States, and only the federal government can act for the United States. So the only place a state can appear in a land title is under the federal government. If you wipe out the federal government's land title, which is what the militia types claim they're doing, it doesn't become state land. It becomes tribal land.
Yes, indeed. And Steve Russell, let me ask you, because we just have the verdict, the acquittal of the people, the armed militias, the white Christian militias who took over a federal refuge in Oregon, held it for a long time. The FBI and the federal law enforcement agencies and state law enforcement, they allowed those armed militiamen to come and go as they pleased. They have open communications. They were able to bring supplies and food in. I mean, and then they were acquitted at trial, and they were obviously carrying out an armed seizure of federal property to make their point about land claims. Now you have people, peaceful people without guns in Standing Rock, people from the indigenous communities, from the Sioux people and allies all around the country who have come together, and contrast the way they're being treated with the sort of hands-off approach to the Oregon refuge, and then the acquittal of armed protesters. I mean, just talk about the difference.
Well, the cases are at different places right now. It's hard to say how they're going to wind up. We'll have to see what the juries do with the water protectors. But you've got state authorities in North Dakota. You've got both the North Dakota authorities, and there are police from Nebraska as well. And they are pretty much the ones running the show there. In Oregon, you had the federal government. The federal government, all these years later, is still smarting from the public relations debacles they had in Waco, Texas, when all those kids were killed, and the Ruby Ridge thing. And they have, I hope, learned their lesson that, for example, in Nevada, they had Cliven Bundy, the father of the guys who took over the bird refuge in Oregon. He owed 20 years worth of grazing fees. He took the position that if he owed the fees, he owed the fees to Nevada, not to the federal government. But they decided not to have a firefight over a bunch of grazing fees. And I think that's a good decision. And when these fools took over the bird refuge in Oregon, the feds decided not to go in guns blazing. And I think that was a good decision. Now, what's going on in North Dakota right now is not feds. It is state government, and they've always had a bit different attitude towards indigenous people. They always have. I mean, from the very beginning, the feds were looked at as, to the extent we were going to get any protection, it would be federal. It was not forthcoming when it should have been, but that was the theory of it, that the states had no business with having any Indian relations. That's what the Constitution says, the Indian Commerce Clause. And the feds are supposed to look out for our rights. Well, that's not happening up there right now. But that's a wrinkle in the whole situation that has nothing to do with what happened with the militia. It's a different government. It's a different government agency, and their authority is different. The one thing I'd like to see Right now, it, unless something changes from the way it's going, is the federal government federalized the North Dakota National Guard. And I lived through the mainstream civil rights movement. This is deja vu all over again. And when it gets X amount of violent, and you've got the state bringing the military in, the feds have the authority to turn that around. And that's what Eisenhower did in the 50s. And if it gets, if people start dying there, it's going to be necessary to do that. And it's going to be necessary to raise hell until we get whoever is the president to federalize those National Guard troops.
We're talking with Steve Russell. Steve is a citizen of the Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma. He lives in Texas. He is a Texas trial court judge. He's the associate professor emeritus of criminal justice at Indiana University, Bloomington. Just for our audience, Steve, that may be either too young or because they're not from the United States or may just not have a historical record, what you're talking about is that Dwight D. Eisenhower federalized the struggle, in, say, in Little Rock, Arkansas, where black kids who were going to schools that had been previously all-white schools were being brutalized both by local and state law enforcement as well as racist mobs.
Yes, what happened was there was a federal court order to integrate the schools, and Governor Orville Faubus of the great state of Arkansas called out the Arkansas National Guard to keep the black kids out of school, which is exactly what is happening in North Dakota right now. The North Dakota governor has brought out the National Guard to back up the local police, and it's become a bit of a military action against the water protectors. What General Eisenhower, President Eisenhower did was federalized the National Guard troops, and basically the bayonets changed positions overnight and started pointing in the other direction, and it made a big difference. And the president has authority to do that. Now, I will say that the violence had gotten a lot worse in Little Rock than it's been so far in North Dakota, but it's going downhill quickly in North Dakota.
And when we talk, and just again for our broader audience, when we're talking about the violence in Standing Rock, it's not the violence of the protesters, it's the violence against the protesters, either by private corporate forces, thugs, or from law enforcement, state and local law enforcement. That's where the violence is emanating.
That would be true, and I don't think they call themselves protesters. They call themselves the water protectors. They're not there to make a statement so much as to stop this project they call the Black Snake that is about to come under the Missouri River if they can't stop it.
Right. We're talking with Steve Russell. We're talking on the anniversary of how the Dakotas became states. And as that process unfolded, there was a continuing, enduring war against the indigenous population. And as we can see in Standing Rock, that war has not ended. Steve Russell, we hope you will come back. We're going to continue to follow this story. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Less than 1 week until Election Day, the campaign has taken yet another twist as the FBI reopens an investigation into Hillary Clinton's emails. Meanwhile, the Clinton camp continues to drum up anti-Russia sentiment to cover up the scandals. We are joined by Danaya Evans, a national delegate to the Democratic National Convention for Bernie Sanders. And we're also joined in studio by Walter Smolarek. He is the producer of this show, Loud and Clear. Welcome, Danaya and Walter.
Hello. Thank you so much, Brian, for having me on your show this morning. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me.
Thanks for joining. When acting DNC chairperson Donna Brazile was asked if the Podesta emails were authentic shortly after they came out on October 7th, she said this: "I don't know. I refuse to open these documents. I refuse to allow a foreign government or foreign communities to interfere and meddle and manipulate information. So I don't know if it's true or not true. And I've asked the staff of the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, and all of our Democratic allies, don't open up that crap because it's postmarked from Russia. Well, now she's been told to resign from her position at CNN because the emails actually revealed that she was providing the questions for Hillary Clinton's campaign before debates, questions that she learned of in her position at CNN. CNN has essentially forced her out. She was on a temporary leave anyway to take the position of chairperson of the Democratic National Committee after Deborah Wasserman Schultz was forced to resign because of an earlier email hack showing that she was using the position of the DNC to tilt the election in the favor of Hillary Clinton and against Bernie Sanders and in violation of the Democratic National Committee's own rules. Talk about Donna Brazile's comments, and because they're not just Donna Brazile. That's the mantra of the Democratic Party establishment. Don't open the emails. Don't look at their content. These are fabrications, or these come from a foreign government, mainly Russia.
Well, here's the deal, Brian. As a national delegate and campaigning hard for Bernie Sanders and believing in his vision and seeing how the DNC is corrupted and the system is rigged, we get confirmation over and over and over again. There is no need to read what is being put out there anymore. It's corrupt. Is Hillary going to be convicted? Is Hillary going to have charges pressed against her? Is the FBI truly going to investigate Hillary Clinton? Nothing else matters at this point.
I hear you. I hear you on that. Of course, though, because we have the election coming up, the Clinton campaign has reacted with great panic about the recent email release. They're basically saying the emails this time coming, not the email release, but the FBI's announced investigation or continued investigation based on the emails that were on Anthony Weiner's computer. And Anthony Weiner, of course, is the disgraced husband of Huma Abedin, a top senior advisor to Hillary Clinton. James Comey, when he came out and said, well, we now know that there were more emails. Comey had earlier said Hillary Clinton was responsible for extremely careless handling of her State Department emails because she put them on a personal server, but she was not criminally negligent. In other words, that she would not be charged. At that time, Hillary Clinton said, James Comey and the FBI have cleared my name. They've cleared me of any wrongdoing. They said I made a mistake, but there was nothing criminal. Now Comey says, well, guess what? The investigation is continuing. And the Clinton campaign and Harry Reid, the head of the U.S. Senate, goes on the attack against Comey as if he is acting in concert with Russia to influence the American elections. So while I hear you about the fact that nothing else might matter in the long term, it does matter in the short term. Just talk about how you think it's playing out and the reaction of the Clinton campaign.
Well, as I see it playing out, you know, I watched how the investigation took part when Hillary's email scandal broke loose and WikiLeaks were released. And I read some of the WikiLeaks. I mean, there's a ton of them. And it was infuriating. It was infuriating to me. It was infuriating to my other national delegates, because we've seen that there was a plan put in place over a year ago. There was a plan against Bernie Sanders. There was a plan for the DNC. They shut us out at the DNC as delegates. And we read these emails, and I was appalled. I mean, my mother worked for the Navy, and she explained to me the severity of knowing that when you're using the server, it's for the purpose of the government. It's not your personal emails. So these emails that went back and forth and the details in these emails about campaign and we're gonna set release on Bernie's campaign and we're gonna go ahead and do this and that. I can't believe this is a democracy. I can't believe that I live in a country that's supposed to be ran by a government of, for, and by the people. And there's people in our government, the 1%, the people with the money, the people of power that are running this country behind closed doors with no transparency whatsoever, and they're setting the groundwork for what we call democracy. They're figuring out this is not a democracy. We the people are angry. We're frustrated because we're watching everything come down, these emails. And what can we do about it? What can we do? The emails are coming out. Head of the DNC getting fired. And you have a man like Bernie Sanders, somebody that wants free universal health care, that does not want fracking because it's bad for our environment. Somebody that wants free public college and tuition. And these things seem extreme, but other countries are doing it. And it really ties in to what's going on with North Dakota and Standing Rock. And you look at those people, you look at the Native American population, and no one is taking a stand for those people. The Native Americans, they had a treaty signed in 1851, but somehow our government is not honoring that treaty. That is wrong. Hillary Clinton has not taken a stand for them.
Okay, that's the voice of Danaya Evans. We're also going to be joined in Washington, D.C. by Loud and Clear producer Walter Smolarek. Walter, you've been listening to Danaya, who was a Bernie Sanders delegate, who was part of that whole mass movement that took place in the United States that shook the Democratic Party establishment to its very core. Because Bernie Sanders didn't have the money, he didn't have the support of the Democratic Party establishment, but he had the support of people like Danaya, people all around the country who want change, people who really have taken to heart the message of the Occupy movement in 2011, that the country should not be of, by, and for the 1%, that it should be for the people, the 99%. I want to ask you, Walter, because you are the author of an upcoming book on Hillary Clinton, I want to talk to you about how this saga has unfolded with the email hacks, the WikiLeaks hacks. The Democratic Party says that WikiLeaks is working as an agent, really, of the Russian government, that the information from the email hacks has been weaponized, a new word, and used to influence and meddle in the U.S. elections. And then when James Comey says that the investigation of Hillary Clinton is going to continue 10 days before the election, Harry Reid in the U.S. Senate, the head of the Democrats in the U.S. Senate, essentially said that Comey has a double standard, that he's actually helping Trump, who is helping Putin influence the American elections. I mean, it's quite amazing. But today or yesterday, Walter, the New York Times ran a story, and it says this: law enforcement officials say that none of the investigations so far have found any conclusive or direct link between Mr. Trump and the Russian government. And even the hacking into Democratic emails, FBI and intelligence officials now believe, was aimed at disrupting the presidential election rather than electing Mr. Trump. In other words, the FBI, Walter, has been investigating whether there's any possible connection to Donald Trump and the Russian government for a long time now. And that's the mantra of the Democratic Party establishment. And they, according to the New York Times, a major article yesterday, have found absolutely nothing.
Well, it's completely made up, this narrative about Russia hacking into the DNC, Russia hacking into John Podesta's email account, Russia hacking everything seemingly to rig the election in favor of Donald Trump, which certainly wouldn't be in their interests in the first place. And yeah, so this story, New York Times story, does confirm what, I mean, I think was clear all along, because there's never a shred of evidence presented to support this theory. Now, Hillary Clinton is never asked if she's going to accept the results of the election. Right. I mean, Donald Trump he's, of course, a narcissist. It's somewhat understandable why you would ask him that. But Hillary Clinton is never asked, even though she says that a foreign power, a hostile foreign power, is trying to rig the election, is intervening in the election on behalf of one of the candidates, which would be something unprecedented in U.S. history. So I think she should be asked, are you going to accept the results of the election? Because you're spinning this wild conspiracy theory that, of course, makes people question the legitimacy of the results.
Walter, I want to stay with you for a quick second here. Harry Reid, the head of the Democratic Party in the U.S. Senate, he wrote in an open letter to the FBI Director Comey, an open letter meaning it was for the media. It wasn't really for James Comey. He said, it has become clear that you possess explosive information about close ties and coordination between Donald Trump, his top advisors, and the Russian government, a foreign interest openly hostile to the United States, which Trump praises at every opportunity. Now, of course, I agree with you. Trump is a bigot. He's a right wing, a demagogue. He's a narcissist. There's nothing about Donald Trump that anybody who has a sense of justice could really like. But Donald Trump has not been praising Russia at every turn. And now we have the New York Times article coming out a couple days afterwards that shows that Harry Reid's open letter to James Comey, which was meant for the media and it got lots of media, is based on absolutely nothing.
Yeah, that's right. Again, it's just more evidence that this is a completely made up narrative. Now, what we see in the email hacks, which, as you read at the beginning of the interview, you know, the Democratic National Committee wants desperately to avoid getting out, is so damaging to Harry Reid's party, to the Democratic Party, to Harry Reid's party's candidate, Hillary Clinton, that they'll go to whatever length, they'll say whatever absurdity they need to prevent information, this information from being widely circulated or for this information to be taken seriously. For instance, yesterday, Politico reported that John Podesta has a $7,000 a month contract with the Sandler Foundation. The Sandlers are this extremely wealthy family. They got their money selling mortgages, among other financial products that were highly suspect, a big part of the financial crisis. They were extremely lucky because Wachovia bought their firm in 2006, the year before the bubble burst and the crisis happened, and that actually contributed to Wachovia's financial problems that led to it being acquired by Wells Fargo. So now the Sandlers, who are major donors to the Hillary Clinton campaign, are paying John Podesta $7,000 a month for basically consulting services. And this is something that's highly unusual, even under the extremely corrupt U.S. electoral system where there's all sorts of revolving doors at play. It's very uncommon for like the sitting chair of a presidential campaign to accept this type of business deal with a major donor. But the Clinton camp is so corrupt, John Podesta is so corrupt, that they're willing to do it. I mean, it's the ultimate example of pay for play. And this is the kind of thing, these are the kind of revelations that are in these emails that the Democratic Party desperately, desperately wants to avoid getting out there.
Dania Evans, again, you're a delegate to the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia representing the Bernie Sanders campaign. Walter is right. I mean, the email hacks, the content, when you actually read them, they show that Hillary Clinton, for instance, this was the earlier hack, the WikiLeaks hack. It showed that Hillary Clinton told Goldman Sachs, who was paying her $225,000 to speak, and banks and corporations have given the Clintons more than $100 million in speaking fees since 2000. She said, well, you know, we have to have a public position and a private position. A public position is what we tell, meaning what we tell the people. The private position is the kind of things that she says in private to Goldman Sachs. I mean, this was the cornerstone, really, of you and the Bernie Sanders movement's argument that Hillary Clinton wasn't just untrustworthy, that she was, in fact, in private, the servant of those Wall Street corporations that have done so much to ruin America.
Yes, and it is appalling and disgusting. And I can tell you that I am an activist, and so I want to change things. And I am working on, in Washington State, Initiative 735, which would make Washington State the 18th, Washington the 18th state to call for an amendment to overturn the Citizens United ruling, which the Citizens United ruling created super PACs, which are able to donate unlimited amounts of money into campaigns without the public knowing where the money comes from. And like I said, we want to return to a government of, by, and for people, not a government of the special interests. And so I'm working on this initiative, trying to get the Citizens United ruling overturned. And Nina Turner, she came to Seattle a week or two ago, and she gave a beautiful speech and some motivation for us and spoke about this. You know, as far as campaign finance reform is concerned, we need to do something about it.
Danae, let's go. We have 45 seconds. I want to just give Walter a chance to jump in. Danae is right about Citizens United and about the important initiative in the state of Washington. I mean, it really is of, by, and for money. It's a plutocracy. It's not a democracy.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's very important work that's going on in Washington. You know, the people who finance the campaigns are the ones who have access to power after their candidate is elected. And their candidate is almost always elected because people who finance campaigns oftentimes give money to both sides, right? So they can't lose. They hedge their bets in many situations. Now, of course, there are certain extremely wealthy families that are loyal to one party or the other. But what we've seen from, you know, just the way that the Clinton people talk to each other in these leaks, or, you know, just, you know, the way that Hillary Clinton talked to Goldman Sachs, is that there's a club, you know. It's a pretty small club, and they have access to both economic power and political power in this country. It's going to take a movement of the people to unseat them.
Okay, that was the voice of Walter Smolarek. He is the producer of this show, Loud and Clear. We've also been speaking from the state of Washington to Danae Evans. She was a national delegate to the Democratic National Convention, representing that remarkable Bernie Sanders campaign that swept the country from coast to coast. Danae and Walter, we will continue this discussion later. Well, that's all the time we have. We will be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.